Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. How much cancer screening is too much? That's the question some expert groups have been grappling with in recent weeks and years, and they've come to some surprising conclusions. Not long ago, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force decided that the PSA test for prostate cancer may be doing more harm than good. The panel also concluded that the Pap test for cervical cancer should only be done every 3 years instead of annually. And you may also remember that back in 2009, the task force recommended that mammograms be done less frequently and should start at age 50 rather than at age 40. A new study at Dartmouth found that the number of women helped by mammograms is far less than originally thought. So what's the right balance? How do we weigh the benefits of screening with the medical risks associated with over-testing? This hour, we're talking with a trio of guests who approach the testing dilemma from different angles. We'll hear from the head of radiation oncology at Fox Chase, as well as a bioethicist from the Hastings Center in New York. But we begin with Katherine Hobson, health writer for The Wall Street Journal and lead writer for the paper's health blog. Prior to joining The Wall Street Journal, Katherine spent 9 years at U.S. News and World Report, where she covered the health beat since 2002. Katherine, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Tracy. Nice to be here.
Well, start off by telling us what or who exactly is this U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and how do they do their research?
It's a group of 16 people. They're unpaid. This idea was created in 1984, and the thought was we need a source of independent information on the pros and cons of various preventive services, including screening. So these folks get together and they review the evidence on various preventive services. That includes kind of most famously cancer screening, but also things like, you know, aspirin for preventing heart disease, who should be screened for different infectious diseases, interventions to prevent falls in older folks. They look at all these things, and their primary goal is to consider whether the benefits outweigh the harms. They are not charged. In fact, they are explicitly told not to consider the price of these services, but whether or not they benefit the health or the longevity or the quality of life of the people who might receive them.
And then are they reporting to the Department of Health, or who are they directly reporting to?
They put their recommendations out in the public domain, where they're followed by or not followed, depending on what they are, by practitioners everywhere. And they kind of rank these things with ratings. They rate services by anything from an A, which is strongly recommended, all the way down to a D, which is firmly not recommended, and all the categories in between. Plus, they have an I category for insufficient, where they don't think there's enough information to make a decision or a recommendation one way or another.
Well, speaking of the D rating, that was the letter that came up when we were talking about prostate cancer and the PSA test, that they were prepared to give that a D rating, saying flat out discourage it. Tell us a little bit about that, about, you know, what the PSA test is and what this recommendation means.
That was a change from what they said before. The PSA test is a blood test. It's simple and not particularly expensive in itself. And what it does is it looks for this specific protein in the blood. The problem is, in terms of screening, is that the presence of this protein does not mean that a man has prostate cancer. This protein is released by the prostate gland, and it can signal a whole host of other conditions, some serious and most not. So the problem is that it's not a very specific test in terms of telling you what you want to know as a man, which is, do I have prostate cancer? And more importantly, do I have prostate cancer that is actually going to harm me, that is going to harm my health, my quality of life, cut my life short? Because what we know from autopsy studies is that many, many men die happily from something else at the age of 85, having had prostate cancer. The prostate cancer does not kill every man that it who contracts it, who gets it. So that's the dilemma we come into. And the Preventive Service Task Force previously had said, we really don't have enough information to recommend one way or another for younger men. We can say for sure that older men, we don't think it's a good idea, but for younger men, we're not sure. And now they have come out, as you said, and basically recommended flat out against it for all men.
So because this is as we might say, a simple blood test. What are the risks associated with doing a blood test?
Well, the risks aren't with the blood test. The risks are with everything that follows the blood test. So, you know, you have a blood test, and it indicates that your PSA is in a range where it might be alarming, where it might indicate cancer or something else. So then you go on to have a variety of other, you know, perhaps, if that's what you decide to do, to have other interventions. It could be a prostate biopsy, depending on what that shows. You know, if it shows cancer, you could go on to have surgery or radiation or all of the various technologies and treatments we have at our disposal for prostate cancer. So the issue is not so much the harms of the blood test. The issue is that these treatments and these follow-up tests for prostate cancer, but specifically the treatments, have their own pretty harsh side effects: incontinence, impotence, that kind of thing, which are not insignificant. And, you know, most men would choose to have those side effects probably rather than to be killed, you know, at an early age or earlier than they would have died anyway by prostate cancer. But the problem is that not all of those men who are going to be treated for prostate cancer would actually have been harmed from it. Mm-hmm. So the dilemma is, what do we do with this information we get from the PSA test? And what the task force concluded is they looked at all these studies and they said, you know, there's really no strong evidence that giving this test to men as a population actually helps this population of men live or die any less frequently mm-hmm. from prostate cancer. And so they concluded that they'd recommend against it, which has caused quite a bit of controversy, as you might expect, given that, first of all, there are a lot of men walking around who believe, correctly or incorrectly, that their prostate cancer was caught early by PSA and that their lives were saved by it. So that's kind of the dilemma we come up against.
Catherine, what's been the response from the medical community? Has there been backlash? What are people saying in response to this?
Well, this controversy is not new. I mean, the PSA has been debated for years and years. So no doctor, I don't think, is unaware of that controversy. The difference is what is between them is what they choose to do with their patient and how they choose to present it to their patients. And, you know, there were a couple of kind of articles published a couple weeks ago, or last week, I believe, that kind of, now that we've had a couple weeks to digest this, kind of approached this from a different angle. And they basically said, you know, we appreciate that there's controversy about this and that it doesn't appear to help in these studies, but it's going on, and isn't it better that men have this discussion with their doctor rather than telling? I think that's the criticism I've seen most often of this recommendation, is not so much the review of the evidence that the task force did, but the fact that they're outright recommending against it. Some people have said, wouldn't it have been better if they had maybe given it a C recommendation, where it's not appropriate for most people, but a physician would raise the issue with certain patients that he or she thought might benefit from the test and have a discussion. Mm-hmm. The American Cancer Society, by contrast, also is not, you know, does not come out and endorse this test, and they acknowledge the harms that it can bring. But they say this should be a topic between a man and his physician. They should have a discussion about the pros and the cons, the benefits, the harms, and come to some decision about prostate cancer screening, first of all. And then also, if there is a positive PSA test, what to do about it. It doesn't automatically mean that you need a biopsy, for example. You might be able to wait and follow it. And even if you'd find a cancer, it's not always clear that you have to treat it aggressively. Some men prefer something called watchful waiting or active surveillance, where they keep an eye on it and see if it progresses, so they don't have to go right to those more aggressive treatments. So that's kind of where the debate is now.
Catherine, I want to ask you as well, while we have you with us, about cervical cancer screening, mammograms. There were also some controversial recommendations about those tests as well.
Yeah, the cervical cancer, you know, the pap smear to detect abnormal cells that may indicate cervical cancer is really held up as kind of a paragon in the cancer screening world of an example of something that works. We know that cervical cancer screening works with much more certainty than we can say about certainly PSA screenings and even mammography, just in terms of the magnitude of the benefit. But what the task force said is that really, there are harms. We know there are harms associated with cervical cancer screening, too. It can lead, again, to more invasive tests. Some of those more invasive diagnostic procedures can, in some women, particularly younger women, affect their ability to carry a child to term. So it's not just about false positives and worry and kind of preoccupation about whether, you know, when is the lab result going to come and how am I going to feel about that in the interim. But there are some real harms, and they basically said the way to get around that is to screen women between the ages of 21 and 65, but do it every 3 years. And their review of the evidence said that way you get the most of the benefits, but you get much less of the harm. And a bunch of other groups have put out similar guidelines, including the American Cancer Society. The difference being is that the other groups, including the Cancer Society, but not the task force, have also recommended using a newer test, which actually looks for the virus that causes cervical cancer, HPV, the virus that can be protected against with the vaccine that's been on the market for a couple years. It looks for the presence of that, and these groups say you use that in combination with the pap smear in a certain group of women over 30, and this is a good, kind of the ideal way to look for cancer in that group of women. The task force is kind of saying we don't still quite know whether how we feel about this newer HPV test, so we're sticking with the pap smear for now, which is, you know, the Preventive Services Task Force is known as being fairly conservative in its recommendations. It's usually later to recommend newer technologies than other groups have been, and so this is just another example of that.
Catherine, in our last minute or so of conversation, how likely is it in your view that the medical community will adopt some of these guidelines? Or do you think that, with the fear of malpractice suits, certainly there's revenue lost when tests aren't taken. Do you think that the medical community is likely to adopt these recommendations by and large?
Well, I think surveys and research have shown that in terms of cervical cancer, that doctors are pretty much in the habit of giving a pap smear or whatever test they give every year. I can't speak to how that might change. This might grab the attention of some folks. And I think similarly with the PSA test, PSA test has been around for a while, and it is really ingrained in everyone's habits. I mean, the report from the physical for President Obama just came out recently, and in it mentioned that, you know, President Obama requested a PSA test, and that was a discussion he had with his physician, and he obviously weighed the benefits and the, you know, the pros and the cons and decided to go ahead with it. I would think just that more doctors will go that route, will continue to discuss this with their patients, perhaps emphasizing what they know about the harms maybe a little more than they did before now that there's this outright recommendation against it. But I'm not sure how many doctors will simply not bring this up with their patients.
Catherine, thank you so much for taking time to help us understand what these recommendations are all about and what they could mean for us. We so appreciate your joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Tracy.
When we come back, we'll talk with a Fox Chase cancer specialist and a bioethicist about cancer screening. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY Capitol Records, presenting the Smile Sessions from the Beach Boys, a 5-CD, 2-LP box set, including a 60-page hardbound book. 45 years in the making, the Smile Sessions from the Beach Boys, available now at Amazon.com.
Picky eaters, hectic schedules, rising grocery prices, many families struggle to make meals that fit their budgets, tastes, and lives, and are healthy to boot. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. We'll also talk about cooking with children, Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Politics, family, finance, faith. Too often the conversations are limited to who we know. But in our fast-paced world, it's important to know the new faces at the table and the new ideas that could shape our lives. Whether it's immigration, politics, or parenting, we offer real conversation about real issues. Join us as we explore what's beyond the headlines on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association. educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about new and controversial guidelines for certain types of cancer screenings, like prostate cancer for men and breast and cervical cancer in women. Dr. Eric Horwitz is the chairman of the Department of Radiation Oncology at Fox Chase Cancer Center, where his work focuses on the treatment of cancer with radiation and on caring for prostate cancer patients. Doctor, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you've been listening in on our conversation with Catherine Hobson from the Wall Street Journal, and you're well acquainted with these guidelines from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force that talk about prostate cancer testing, and certainly there have been some guidelines issued on mammograms, on pap smears. As a physician, what do you make of these kinds of guidelines?
Every time these guidelines come out, part of me is I get nervous thinking this is going to take a lot of time and discussion with my patients. And I think especially with the prostate cancer guidelines, there's issues that I have with them. I think that they've actually served a very valuable, they provide a very valuable tool for us. The debate, and it's true in that there's clearly men who have prostate cancer that do not need to have the PSA test, and if they get diagnosed with cancer, they do not need to have treatment. The problem is that we don't quite know yet who those patients are. We have a decent sense, but the concern I have is that prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men, and it can kill you if it's not properly treated or if it's not treated at all. And it's like, how do we identify the patients where we really can watch and those who should be screened and who should be treated?
Well, how do you arrive at that decision as a doctor? How do you decide who needs to even have the PSA to begin with?
Well, certainly starting with, and even in these guidelines, there's clearly a couple groups of men who absolutely should be screened. Those who have a family history, a father, a brother, sometimes an uncle, absolutely they should be screened. African-American men are at an increased risk of prostate cancer than Caucasian men. They, too, should be screened. And even in the guidelines, they state that these groups should continue to be screened. Mm. So certainly from a conversation point of view, these are people that should be screened, and they should actually start earlier than 50. Beyond that, it's a discussion you have to have with the patient.
Yeah.
And as I said, I'm of the generation of physician where I think more conversation, more information is a good thing. And it's not like now in the old days where we would tell a patient, you must do this, please don't ask me questions. I think you have to have the conversation because you're going to weigh the benefits of the test and really the test itself. There are really not very many side effects. But then it's going to be, well, what happens if we do discover a cancer? What do we do about it? And sometimes you can talk about that a little bit in advance, although it is kind of difficult until you actually know the exact details to have a detailed discussion with a patient with all the pros and cons of treatment. You just have to provide as much information as possible. You just have to have a discussion and say, this is what's going to happen if, you know, if the biopsy, you know, if the PSA turns out to be elevated or there's a change and we recommend a biopsy, this is what we think you ought to do. If a patient then says, you know what, I'm not interested in it, maybe we'll wait down the road, that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And that can be a very tough call. And I think as Americans, we have this notion that all cancer is bad and needs to be removed immediately. So I think oftentimes if we hear that we're at risk for something, you know, the immediate sense is, I've got to get rid of this and I've got to do it yesterday. But that's not necessarily the case with some cancers, right?
Exactly. And in fact, prostate cancer probably is the poster child for this because in one way, there's first of all multiple ways to treat prostate cancer, but it is one of the few cancers where, in fact, you do not have to treat it because it's really not true for the majority of cancers. And that's something that I don't think many patients know up front. And whether it's the primary care physician, whether it's a urologist, or whether it's one of our specialists who then just treats prostate cancer, you know, we need to tell patients that. They need to know that.
Yeah.
And you get into the fact of even if there's a medical reason to do something or not, you then do need to deal with the personality of individual people. People react in different ways to different things.
I don't think you can underestimate, Eric, the importance of the emotional piece of it. For some people, just the testing is so anxiety-producing. And then if, you know, the number's elevated and it still doesn't necessarily mean that there's cancer, or maybe there's cancer but it's the kind that doesn't really need to be treated, you know, the train has already left the station for a lot of people in terms of their anxiety, right?
Absolutely. So there's some patients where even you can say, this is a cancer that you do not need to have treatment. But if it's going to eat away at you every day, if it's going to stress you out, if it's going to stress your family out, well, then you know what? That is actually an appropriate reason to treat a person. And if a person says, you know what? I understand all the pros and cons. I'm really okay with this. Let's just kind of check it. Let's just follow it. That's actually also a good choice.
Yeah. You don't want people having heart attacks over the stress because they're not sure what's going to happen.
Exactly. And that's why I
believe their situation.
The more you know, the better informed you are, the better you can make a good choice.
Yeah. It puts physicians, I think, in an interesting position to have to be able to evaluate not only their patient's physical condition, but also, their emotional condition and to be able to advise them, whether you're the kind of person who needs to pursue this further or maybe not.
Well, and absolutely, because again, with prostate cancer, because of their choices, it's ultimately the patient's choice in what they do. I can't tell a person, you have to do this. But it's also really confusing. There's so much information out there. People hear so many different things from different people. The question I always hear is like, well, how am I supposed to decide? You're the one who went to school for 20 years. And that's true. But what you end up then saying is like, well, it's my job to provide you with the information to make a smart choice. And that's what the role of the physician is, whether it's the specialist or the primary care physician.
Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. The number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about cancer screening and how much is too much when it comes to certain types of cancer. We've talked about the PSA, and you overheard us talking in the first segment of the program about mammogram recommendations as well and pap smear recommendations, and there is the notion that we may be overdoing those as well. As a cancer specialist, what do you think about that?
I think it's many of the same issues. Now, with pap smears, I think there's really, really good evidence to show that you can discover cancers early, and treatment is much, much more effective. Mm. You can absolutely cure people when you treat a cervical cancer early rather than late. There's definitely some of the new tests with cervical cancer where you're testing now for HPV, human papillomavirus, where kind of combining both the HPV test and the pap smear, you actually can do the pap smear less often, but still be very effective in how you can appropriately screen a person. So in that way, it's changing, but I don't think screening is as controversial in that instance. It's just, is there a better way that we can do it? Mammograms, I think it's many of the same issues with PSA and with prostate cancer screening, because we know that mammograms will find cancers when they're early, and it's absolutely easier to treat a cancer when it's early as opposed to when it's a bigger cancer, when it's a later diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's the issue that you get into with screening where there's societal issues versus individual issues. And you can say for a whole population, for a group, I'm not sure what the benefit is. Or you can maybe say, in fact, there isn't a benefit. But for an individual person, there absolutely can be a benefit.
Yeah.
And for my colleagues who treat breast cancer, many times we'll talk to the patient who we've successfully treated, and it's like, it was a good outcome because this cancer was discovered early and we treated you. Same thing with prostate cancer. So I think, my colleagues in the breast cancer world, they're having many of these same discussions, and actually they've been having the discussions longer than we have as far as what's the best thing to do for a patient. But the data is mixed, and it's how you weigh population versus individual.
Yeah. Is it possible, Eric, in a mammogram, for instance, I've heard with chest x-rays that it's possible to see a spot on, someone's lungs that may not be cancer at all. There may be some abnormalities that are not dangerous. There may be any number of things that are not cancer, but are sort of warning signs for a physician to say, we need to look at this further. Is that true with the mammogram? Is it possible to see spots or dark shadows that may be something else?
Yes, and with apologies to my my breast cancer colleagues, absolutely, there's some things that clearly are benign, meaning it's not cancer. There's absolutely some things when you see in images that are clearly very worrisome, this represents cancer. And there's then, unfortunately, a large area in the middle where there's a gray area. I think with both mammograms and with PSA, one of the things that we have learned over time is that each test by itself isn't always perfect, but if you kind of string them together over a period of time, you can see changes. And then the changes could be the red flag to say, hey, you know what? There's something that's changed. This is not your normal. Now let's further investigate.
Yeah.
And then when you get into screening, one of the things that's come up is that maybe you don't have to necessarily do the test every year, but if you've established a baseline early on and then you do it a certain frequency, whether it's yearly, whether it's every other year, you'll see the change over time. And then that can be the identifier to say, hey, we need to pursue something. We need to biopsy. I think that's true for both mammograms and for PSA.
And on the flip side of these recommendations, you've certainly got advocacy groups who are outraged at, you know, the notion that we should be doing less testing over longer periods of time. And within those groups are many people who will flat out say, that test saved my life. How could you possibly recommend that it not be done or it not be done as frequently? Is that the case? Is it the test that ultimately does, you know, save a person's life? And what do you say about the advocacy groups on the other side of this?
I mean, it's a true statement, and I think that's where you get into the individual versus the group.
Yeah.
And this is actually the conversation I've been having with my patients for the last 2 weeks since these guidelines came out, where they're like, I wouldn't be here if I didn't have my PSA, and I wouldn't, you know, and this cancer wouldn't have got discovered for a couple of years. The problem is, and this is what I'd said earlier on, there's some prostate cancers that do not need to be treated.
Yeah.
But there's absolutely many prostate cancers that are only discovered because of PSA that will kill you in a certain number of years if you don't treat the person. And I don't want to go back to the 1960s and 70s and early 80s where cancers were never discovered until they were really large and bulky.
Yeah.
There were fewer options, and then treatment wasn't nearly as successful.
Do you have a sense of, out of the number of men who are tested for the PSA and maybe have elevated levels, how many of those men actually develop life-threatening cancer as opposed to those who may develop cancer, but it's not the thing that they're going to die of, probably?
Well, right now in 2011, there's typically about 130,000 new cases of prostate cancer a year. It's less than a quarter that are considered clinically insignificant. The number changes a lot. The majority of cancers now in the United States, and it's actually Europe's a little bit behind us, but even now they've caught up in that. The majority of cancers are PSA-detected cancers, but a certain percentage of those PSA-detected cancers, and it's at least 40%, are clinically significant cancers that really require treatment, and I don't think there's any controversy. There are more than 1 million prostate biopsies done a year, so you can see the disconnect between the number of biopsies and the number of cancers that are discovered.
Yeah.
But the clear majority of patients who are diagnosed have cancers that we actually would recommend treatment.
Yeah. Well, we'll go to the phones, and we'll welcome George to our conversation. Hi, George. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yes. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer subsequent to a biopsy that came after I had 1 year of elevated PSA. And I'm a patient of an internist who did not recommend routine PSAs, but I asked for them anyway. So as a result of that, the biopsy indicated a particular location, aggressive type of cancer cells, and I had a prostatectomy, and the pathology showed that it had already breached the capsule, which means that it was beginning to spread, at least that's my understanding. Now, I practice wait and watch, and it's turned out well. My PSA has been undetectable for 3 years. But had I not had the PSA, had I not had the biopsy, I probably would have cancer that had spread from my prostate. And I'm 61, otherwise healthy, no other indications of any kind of prostate problem whatsoever. But for the test, you know, I would probably, and I also, I'm for it, and I've also suffered the post-surgery consequences of some incontinence and impotence. So I'm just saying people need to hear that side of it, too.
I agree completely. That's part of the discussion. I mean, there's two parts. One is to screen or not to screen, and then when a patient gets diagnosed, do you treat or not to treat? And certainly with the discussion with treatment, you need to go over the pros and cons of each treatment, and there are pros and cons. One of the things that keeps getting talked about are the side effects, and they are real side effects, whether the surgical side effects or the radiation side effects. I do think over time some of the side effects have changed. And, you know, you can talk about what was done in the 1980s and 1990s versus what's done in 2011. There's some clear differences, and there's been definitely a reduction in side effects. But if a patient, it's our job to provide this information to a patient, because if you don't know what the potential side effects are of either of the two main treatments, I don't think he can make a good choice, a good decision. Exactly, an informed decision. So it's crucial. I mean, these are not things to be taken lightly. Incontinence and impotence are two very big side effects. The rates of these side effects vary between radiation or surgery. One of the things that I always say is that you're supposed to get multiple opinions. It's really difficult with cancer once a patient's diagnosed to actually take time, because it's everybody's normal reaction to say, I want treatment yesterday.
Yeah.
But especially with prostate cancer, because there's choices and because each choice has potentially very different side effects, you need to do your due diligence. You need to think about it. You need to talk about it with physicians, with family, and figure out what works best for you. And it's hard sometimes with just the stress of the diagnosis to do that, but I always advocate for all my patients, even when they say, oh, I want you to treat with radiation. I'm like, are you sure? You know, really think about it, and it's really okay to talk to somebody else. It doesn't hurt my feelings.
Want to invite our listeners to join us. The number is 888-477-9499. We should mention that while we are not able to answer personal questions as it relates to cancer cases, certainly we would be interested in hearing your story. If you have been down this road with testing, maybe you think you've had too much testing, you've been overtreated, or perhaps not enough, but we'd love for you to share that as well. 888-477-9499. Eric, is there a fear with doctors of malpractice issues if they were to adopt this recommendation? I mean, do you as a physician say to yourself, "Hey, I'm not going to recommend that my patient not get this test because if, as was the case in our caller just a few minutes ago, I don't recommend it, and then something shows up later, does that come back to haunt me?"
I mean, it depends. Like for me as a specialist, I tend to see patients when they've already have a diagnosis of cancer. Mm-hmm. Although there's definitely, we have these conversations and I'll hear about it a lot. I guess it's unrealistic for me to say that it's not a concern because depending upon this, you know, and especially in this area, it is a concern. I think that if you document well the conversation to say, hey, we talked about, should I do the PSA or not? In that way, and especially with these guidelines and with the different results of the different studies, you are safe. I mean, it's controversial. It's not clear cut what to do or what not to do. But I think you have to have the conversation with the patient. If you don't have the conversation with the patient, well, then it definitely would be a problem if something then happened.
Yeah. So you need to at least bring it up and at least help them to understand what's going to happen if I go this way, what's going to happen if I go that way. We've all read and heard about evidence-based practice. Is that what this is, essentially?
Yeah, so this is a phrase that's been around for a while, but especially in the process of healthcare reform, you're going to hear about it much more. Now, working at a national cancer center, it's something we've lived and breathed for the last 20, 30 years. But it's basically evidence-based medicine means that is there data to support what you do? Part of being a physician, you know, you need to use data to do it, but it's also with time comes experience, and it ends up being a combination of both data and experience to say what's the best treatment for you as an individual person. But it can't all be that I have a hunch or I treated somebody like this 10 years ago, so let me treat you this way. That's not appropriate, and that's not evidence-based medicine. And with evidence-based medicine, there's three different classes. There's class 1, class 2, and class 3. Class 1 is the best, and that's essentially where you have randomized prospective data, where you've done a big clinical trial where, to the best of our ability, we've eliminated bias to figure out one treatment versus another. There's other kind of evidence where you've got single institution, where you look back at your own experience over the last, you know, however long, you know, the more people you've treated, the more time you have, the stronger the data, but it's not the same as class one. Class two is in between. So that's what the difference with evidence-based information is.
We're talking about cancer screening. How much is too much, and how do you know when you ought to be tested or when it's okay to leave things alone and just keep an eye on it? We are talking with a Fox Chase cancer specialist. We'll be talking with a bioethicist as well when Radio Times comes right back, and we welcome your calls as well. Stay with us.
"10,000 Villages in Ephrata" supports WHYY, hosting their annual holiday bag event Saturday, November 5th from 10 to 5, with fairly traded oriental rugs made by Bunyad Artisans. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the Great Tech War of 2012, we talk with Farhad Manju about how Apple, Google, Amazon, and Facebook are on the verge of war against each other. Manju's article about this is in Fast Company. He's a technology columnist for Slate. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll speak with the writer-director of Margin Call. David Demby says it's the best film ever made about Wall Street. Also, President Obama says he'll have the last word on the controversial Keystone Pipeline. Protesters are heading to the White House to try to influence his decision. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from PNC Wealth Management, helping customers live achievement by crafting personalized solutions to grow, preserve, and transfer wealth. More information is available from John Conaway at 215-585-5438.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscowain. We're talking about cancer screening and some fairly controversial guidelines that have been issued or recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Specifically, we're talking about recent changes to the guidelines for prostate cancer screening, as well as some new recommendations for breast and cervical cancer testing. We've been talking with Dr. Eric Horowitz, head of radiation oncology at Fox Chase. And joining us now in the conversation is Nancy Berlinger. Nancy is a research scholar and deputy director at the Hastings Center, which is a nonprofit bioethics research institute in Garrison, New York. Her work focuses on ethics issues in the organization and delivery of healthcare. Nancy, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let me ask you first, as an ethicist, as you look at these recommendations, what do you think of them?
Well, this is information that, as Dr. Horowitz has said, is not especially new in the clinical setting, especially in clinical oncology. This is something that's been discussed for some time. However, the information has been making its way into the public sector, into the public conversation, probably especially in the past 2 years. We saw the debate over the mammogram guidelines and now PSA. And, of course, these are the types of tests that individuals discuss regularly with their primary care providers, who are not usually clinical oncologists. They're OBGYNs, urologists, internists, and so on. So that's why I think you're seeing a lot of attention to something that has probably been an ongoing conversation in cancer care circles for a long time.
Do you think, Nancy, that these recommendations are about good medicine? Are they about cost containment? Is it a little bit of both? What do you think?
Both, actually. With respect to the individual patient, which is how most people think about medical decision-making, you know, what's right for me, what's right for my loved ones, when we talk about ethics, when we talk about informed decision-making, it's premised on information, not just the fact of making a decision with reference to one's own values and preferences, and that would be, you know, honoring the patient by bringing that into the conversation. But it's very important that the medical information itself be sound and be provided to the patient when they're making a decision, when they're considering a test and so on. And the end of your conversation with Dr. Horowitz, he was talking about that as well, the importance of not just presenting, well, here are the guidelines, here's the most recent recommendations to the field, but how is this translated for a patient who is thinking primarily about, you know, what they need, what's right for them. And then, of course, it is very important when talking about populations, that 1 in 5,000 number or whatever it may be, to be very clear for a clinician, be very clear with patients about what that means for a person, because population statistics don't translate to individual people.
And that's the dilemma, Nancy, isn't it? This is what Eric and I were talking about, in detail just a few minutes ago, just that balance for the clinician of deciding, you know, who really needs to have more extensive testing and sort of weighing that individual relative to the population. And that's really where the art lies, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, one way of pointing this out is you can't better your odds of not dying of cancer by having treatment you don't need. That could actually be harmful to you, because no treatment is without burden, and cancer treatment is tremendously burdensome. In certain cases, it can also save your life. Mm. So explaining that, and especially given that the person who's doing the first explanation of this is probably not a cancer specialist, because as Dr. Horowitz says, when he sees someone, they've already been referred to him, the quality of that information is tremendously important. Yeah. I think another thing that's very important is the difference between facts and beliefs. We don't act on every fact that we know. We absorb new facts all the time. We can think that it was going to rain today, and it turns out to be sunny, and we just get on with it, you know. William James, the great American philosopher, said, a belief is something you're willing to act on. That's the test of a belief. Mm-hmm. And our beliefs about health and about what's good for us and what's bad for us can be very deeply entrenched within individuals and supported by communities. And cancer, in particular, is something where people get constant messages from it. Yeah. Last month I was in a grocery store, and it was because of breast cancer awareness. The amount of pink in this grocery store was absolutely amazing. Mylar balloons and pink ribbons, air freshener, things I'd never seen before. And this is the clear message is you can prevent breast cancer if you do certain things. And one of these messages that comes through this is if you get mammograms, you know, and if you rigorously stick to a certain schedule. But how well does this belief stand up? Now, we know that mammograms don't prevent cancer. They detect. Mm-hmm. And yet we want to believe that we can do something to prevent something that we reasonably fear. So how do we now take on board the idea that mammogram, like all tools, is an imperfect tool, and that some of the things it detects may not require cancer treatment, and that it also may not be helpful in slowing the progression of certain aggressive cancers? All of this complicates a relatively simple belief.
It really does. A number of people would like to talk with you both, so let's go to the phones. We'll start off in Souderton and welcome John to our conversation. Hi, John.
Hello. Yes, hi. I have a question for Dr. Horowitz.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about ultrasound. Can it be used in and of itself to detect the aggressive forms of cancer, that is, before it's penetrated the capsule?
It depends. I mean, an ultrasound is part of the biopsy procedure, and it's actually what will guide the urologist when they're placing the needles into the prostate in specific regions to sample the prostate. There's been some clinical studies with different kinds of ultrasound, more sensitive ultrasounds that can measure flow and see different structures. In general, though, it cannot identify the cancer, and in fact, most prostate cancers you can't see on an ultrasound or on CT or an MRI. Sometimes you could see, say, extracapsular extension, which is when the cancer spreads beyond the capsule. That would tend to be a very big cancer. And then at that point, you could either feel it or ultrasound could see it. But in general, ultrasound does not see the cancer. Mm.
So is there a point where ultrasound makes sense then, where it is wise to take that step, or is it something that generally would be ruled out?
Oh, well, no, it's part of the biopsy because... You actually, to do modern biopsy, over time they used to be, it was random, where the needles would just kind of go in, say, the right side and then the left side. Based on a bunch of studies that have been done on prostatectomy specimens, it was identified, say, hey, this is most likely where we're going to see prostate cancer, so let's be more organized. So then it was what was called a sextant biopsy, where it was in six regions, three on each side. Then it went to 10 cores, a core is each sample. The modern standard of care right now is a 12-core sample in specific regions of the prostate, and you're using ultrasound to guide it.
Thank you so much, John, for your call and for your question. We'll go next to Kennett Square and welcome Bob to Radio Times. Hi, Bob.
Good day, Terry. One aspect of this conversation that I've never heard discussed, and that is the implications of an abnormally low PSA for a man's age group. When I was 60, I had a series of PSAs that were never higher than 1.1. Subsequent to surgery, we found out I had a Gleason 7 that involved about a third of the prostate. And I then found out that roughly, I think, 25 or 30% of the men, there's a correlation between very, very low PSAs and aggressive cancers. Am I correct on this?
So
the argument for having routine tests at least as a baseline?
So you're absolutely correct. And this is where you get into the issue with PSA. And what I will say is the things that come up in headlines all the time that I personally find frustrating are that PSA is useless and, oh, it's prostate cancer, don't worry about it. And that's where both those statements aren't true. There's clearly some prostate cancers we don't need to treat, we probably don't even need to find, but there are definitely prostate cancers that are very aggressive. And the PSA test, the value of the PSA test is to do it multiple times over time. each number by itself isn't going to guarantee they're going to be diagnosed. And one of the things we hadn't said yet is when you talk about screening, it's actually both a PSA and a rectal exam each year. Because they kind of complement each other, because there's definitely men who have very high PSAs that do not have cancer, but there's actually a group of men who have very low PSAs and do have cancer, and in that way you can kind of miss it with PSA. The rectal exam can add something, but that's why doing the test multiple times over time you can see a pattern. There's also a very small group of men who have Gleason score is a number, it's a number, it's a value based on the shape of the cancer cell, and it's a surrogate for aggressiveness, and it's a number that's always between 2 and 10. 2 to 6 is considered low risk, 7 is considered middle risk, and 8, 9, and 10 is considered high risk. There's a very small group of men who have Gleason 9 and 10 cancers that are much more aggressive than other prostate cancers, and they tend to be so aggressive they actually don't make PSA. So every once in a while, and thankfully it's relatively rare, we'll actually see somebody who had a PSA even under 1 who had a very large cancer. Mm. So that's why PSA is valuable, but it's not the end all.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your call. We'll go next to Berwyn and Paula. Welcome, Paula, to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. My topic here is ovarian cancer and the PSA test. And the CA-125 test. On the recommendation of a friend of my sister's who had ovarian cancer, this friend said, I'm trying to get all my friends to get a CA-125 test. And so my sister mentioned this to her doctor, and things went on, and she did get the test. Turns out she had stage 1 ovarian cancer, which is a deadly cancer, total hysterectomy. She did go through chemotherapy, and this is 5 years later. She appears to be fine. That led us to do some genetic testing, my sister and me, and we do have the BRCA mutation. But this test, which I assume is a blood test and maybe not very expensive, probably saved her life. She had no symptoms. And I've heard oncologists say, one of whom is in my family, that the prognosis, I can't get what he said, but when you take the test, giving this test does not prolong life, the treatment thereafter does not prolong life. Well, I think it did for her.
Hmm.
And if it's a basic test, it's not expensive, especially if a doctor would say, do you have cancer in your family, breast or ovarian, that it could be a lifesaver.
Well, Paula, I think you've hit upon exactly what we've been talking about in this conversation, that individual versus the population.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I was going to say. For you, as an individual, absolutely CA-125 was a beneficial thing. The thing with CA-125, and that's a tumor marker just like a PSA. It's a blood test. But the data for CA-125 is really limited as a screening tool, and it hasn't been shown that within populations that we've been able to effectively find ovarian cancer and certainly earlier stage ovarian cancer using the test. So in general, it's not used as a screening tool. It's used when a person's been treated for ovarian cancer to follow afterwards. But in general, it's just not, our terminology is sensitive and specific enough to identify cases across a group. But again, for certain individuals, it absolutely can be helpful.
And Nancy, that brings us to, the credo that doctors have, first do no harm. So the question is, is testing harm? Is not testing harm? And how do we know the difference?
Well, any medical procedure, and we're talking about tests and scans today, I think what's important is to think of them as not neutral. Any intervention is an opportunity to do good or an opportunity to do harm. And this is something that clinicians, thoughtful clinicians, will be thinking about. Am I ordering this test in a routine way? Am I thinking about whether or not this is the right test for this particular patient? As has been talked about already via some of the callers, sometimes you have to customize for a particular patient. Like, for example, the caller, it sounds as though she had the tumor marker test first and then found out that she had the BRCA mutation. And some people find out the part about the mutation first, maybe because there's a strong family history of breast and ovarian cancer, and then they find out that, that would usually trigger a need for a greater monitoring because it is known that their risk is so much higher.
Hmm. Well, in our last couple of minutes here, we have a primary physician on the line. We want to go to Hokesson and welcome Dr. Taylor to our conversation. Hi.
Hi. One of the questions that I have and one of the dilemmas that I face in primary care is patients' expectations of having a complete physical exam and the controversy of doing just not a mammogram but just a simple breast exam and teaching the self-breast exam. I feel personally that, you know, patients want to be cared for and they like being examined in fully, and yet the evidence doesn't necessarily support that it's helpful.
I think it's with the breast exam and with mammography, I think it's a thing that actually patients, and with empowerment for patients, it's something that a woman should perform herself and just kind of get a sense of what her normal is. And then again, over time, she can become aware of what's different. Screening using the breast exam is not the most, it's not an accurate thing. But it can be, again, it can be complimentary where it's a trigger to say, hey, I felt something, this is different, should we investigate it? And then you would do a mammogram or whatever else is appropriate. But I think this is actually where the patient actually can learn to do this. And actually, those are what the recommendations and the guidelines are, is that patients should be able to do this and just learn what their normal is.
Yeah. So it sounds like the bottom line as we begin to wrap up our program, and Dr. Taylor, thank you for your call. It really is an individual thing, and this is really down to the patient and physician and a decision that they should make together.
Absolutely. I think all these controversies with the guidelines, I think they're actually good. And if they trigger a conversation and if they trigger that there's more information out there, it will help with your individual care.
Yeah. Nancy, very quickly in our last 15 seconds, any advice that you would have for people who are puzzled about these new guidelines and what to do?
I think the important thing is to put this up as on the agenda when you're going to talk with your primary care provider to say, I'd like to talk through this, and I want to know what you think, and I want to make this part of that conversation.
Well, thank you both so much. Nancy Berlinger from the Hastings Institute, Dr. Eric Horowitz from Fox Chase. Thank you both for helping us understand this a little bit better.
Thank you much for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and you are listening to Radio Times.